Chapter 98. The Harvest Supper. As Adam was going homeward on Wednesday evening, in the 6 o'clock sunlight, he saw in the distance the last load of barley winding its way towards the yard gate of the Hall Farm, and heard the chant of "Harvest Home," rising and sinking like a wave. Fainter and fainter, and more musical through the growing distance, the falling dying sound still reached him, as he neared the Willow Brook. The low westering sun shone right on the shoulders of the old Binton Hills, turning the unconscious sheep into bright spots of light, shone on the windows of the cottage too, and made them aflame with a glory beyond that of amber or amethyst. It was enough to make Adam feel that he was in a great temple, and that the distant chant was a sacred song. "It's wonderful," he thought, "how that sound goes to one's heart almost like a funeral bell, for all it tells one oh the joyfulest time o' the year, and the time when men are mostly the thankfulest. I suppose it's a bit hard to us to think anything's over and gone in our lives, and there's a parting at the root of all our joys. It's like what I feel about Dinah. I should never ha' come to know that her love would be the greatest o' blessings to me, if what I counted a blessing hadn't been wrenched and torn away from me, and left me with a greater need, so as I could crave, and hunger for a greater, and a better comfort." He expected to see Dinah again this evening, and get leave to accompany her as far as Oakburn. And then he would ask her to fix some time when he might go to Snowfield, and learn whether the last best hope that had been born to him must be resigned like the rest. The work he had to do at home, besides putting on his best clothes, made it 7, before he was on his way again to the Hall Farm, and it was questionable whether, with his longest and quickest strides, he should be there in time even for the roast beef, which came after the plum pudding, for Mrs. Poyser's supper would be punctual. Great was the clatter of knives and pewter plates and tin cans when Adam entered the house, but there was no hum of voices to this accompaniment. The eating of excellent roast beef, provided free of expense, was too serious a business to those good farm laborers to be performed with a divided attention, even if they had had anything to say to each other which they had not. And Mr. Poyser, at the head of the table, was too busy with his carving to listen to Bartle Massey's or Mr. Craig's ready talk. "Here, Adam," said Mrs. Poyser, who was standing and looking on to see that Molly and Nancy did their duty as waiters, "here's a place kept for you between Mr. Massey and the boys. It's a poor tale you couldn't come to see the pudding when it was whole." Adam looked anxiously round for a fourth woman's figure, but Dinah was not there. He was almost afraid of asking about her. Besides, his attention was claimed by greetings, and there remained the hope that Dinah was in the house, though perhaps disinclined to festivities on the eve of her departure. It was a goodly sight, that table, with Martin Poyser's round good-humored face, and large person at the head of it helping his servants to the fragrant roast beef and pleased, when the empty plates came again. Martin, though usually blessed with a good appetite, really forgot to finish his own beef tonight. It was so pleasant to him to look on in the intervals of carving, and see how the others enjoyed their supper. For were they not men who, on all the days of the year except Christmas Day and Sundays, ate their cold dinner, in a makeshift manner, under the hedgerows, and drank their beer out of wooden bottles with relish certainly, but with their mouths towards the zenith, after a fashion more endurable to ducks than to human bipeds? Martin Poyser had some faint conception of the flavor such men must find in hot roast beef and fresh drawn ale. He held his head on one side and screwed up his mouth, as he nudged Bartle Massey, and watched half-witted Tom Tholer, otherwise known as Om Saft, receiving his second plateful of beef. A grin of delight broke over Tom's face as the plate was set down before him, between his knife and fork, which he held erect, as if they had been sacred tapers. But the delight was too strong to continue smoldering in a grin. It burst out the next instant in a long-drawn ah-ha, followed by a sudden collapse into utter gravity, as the knife and fork darted down on the prey. Martin Poyser's large person shook with his silent, unctuous laugh. He turned towards Mrs. Poyser to see if she too had been observant of Tom, and the eyes of husband and wife met in a glance of good-natured amusement. Tom Saft was a great favorite on the farm, where he played the part of the old jester, and made up for his practical deficiencies by his success in repartee. His hits, I imagine, were those of the flail, which falls quite at random, but nevertheless smashes an insect now and then. They were much quoted at sheep shearing and haymaking times, but I refrain from recording them here, lest Tom's wit should prove to be like that of many other bygone jesters eminent in their day, rather of a temporary nature, not dealing with the deeper and more lasting relations of things. Tom accepted Martin Poyser at some pride in his servants and laborers, thinking with satisfaction that they were the best worth their pay of any set on the estate. There was Kester Bale, for example, Beale, probably, if the truth were known, but he was called Bale, and was not conscious of any claim to a fifth letter. The old man with the close leather cap, and the network of wrinkles on his sun-browned face. Was there any man in Loamshire who knew better the utter of all farming work? He was one of those invaluable laborers who can not only turn their hand to everything, but excel in everything they turn their hand to. It is true Kester's knees were much bent outward by this time, and he walked with a perpetual curtsy, as if he were among the most reverend of men. And so he was, but I am obliged to admit that the object of his reverence was his own skill, towards which he performed some rather affecting acts of worship. He always thatched the ricks, for if anything were his forte more than another, it was thatching, and when the last touch had been put to the last beehive rick, Kester, whose home lay at some distance from the farm, would take a walk to the rickyard in his best clothes on a Sunday morning and stand in the lane, at a due distance, to contemplate his own thatching walking about to get each rick from the proper point of view. As he curtsied along, with his eyes upturned to the straw knobs imitative of golden globes at the summits of the beehive ricks, which indeed were gold of the best sort, you might have imagined him to be engaged in some pagan act of adoration. Kester was an old bachelor and reputed to have stockings full of coin, concerning which his master cracked a joke with him every pay night. Not a new unseasoned joke, but a good old one, that had been tried many times before, and had worn well. "H. young meester's a merry man," Kester frequently remarked, for having begun his career by frightening away the crows under the last Martin Poyser but one, he could never cease to account the reigning Martin a young master. I am not ashamed of commemorating old Kester. You and I are indebted to the hard hands of such men, hands that have long ago mingled with the soil they tilled so faithfully, thriftily making the best they could of the earth's fruits, and receiving the smallest share as their own wages. Then, at the end of the table, opposite his master, there was Alick, the shepherd and head man, with the ruddy face and broad shoulders, not on the best terms with old Kester. Indeed, their intercourse was confined to an occasional snarl, for though they probably differed little concerning hedging and ditching, and the treatment of ewes, there was a profound difference of opinion between them, as to their own respective merits. When Titterus and Melibius happen to be on the same farm, they are not sentimentally polite to each other. Alick, indeed, was not by any means a honeyed man. His speech had usually something of a snarl in it, and his broad-shouldered aspect something of the bulldog expression on "you meddle with me, and I won't meddle with you." But he was honest even to the splitting of an oat grain, rather than he would take beyond his acknowledged share, and as close-fisted with his master's property, as if it had been his own, throwing very small handfuls of damaged barley to the chickens, because a large handful affected his imagination painfully with a sense of profusion. Good-tempered Tim, the wagoner, who loved his horses, had his grudge against Alick in the matter of corn. They rarely spoke to each other, and never looked at each other, even over their dish of cold potatoes. But then, as this was their usual mode of behavior towards all mankind, it would be an unsafe conclusion that they had more than transient fits of unfriendliness. The bucolic character at Hayslip, you perceive, was not of that entirely genial, merry, broad-grinning sort, apparently observed in most districts visited by artists. The mild radiance of a smile was a rare sight on the field laborer's face, and there was seldom any gradation between bovine gravity and a laugh. Nor was every laborer so honest as our friend Alick. At this very table, among Mr. Poyser's men, there is that big Ben Tholoway, a very powerful thresher, but detected more than once in carrying away his master's corn in his pockets, an action which, as Ben was not a philosopher, could hardly be ascribed to absence of mind. However, his master had forgiven him, and continued to employ him, for the Tholoways had lived on the common time out of mind, and had always worked for the Poysers. And on the whole, I dare say, society was not much the worse, because Ben had not 6 months of it at the treadmill, for his views of depredation were narrow, and the House of Correction might have enlarged them. As it was, Ben ate his roast beef tonight with a serene sense of having stolen nothing more than a few peas and beans as seed for his garden since the last harvest supper, and felt warranted in thinking that Alick's suspicious eye, forever upon him, was an injury to his innocence. But now the roast beef was finished, and the cloth was drawn, leaving a fair large deal table for the bright drinking cans, and the foaming brown jugs, and the bright brass candlesticks, pleasant to behold. Now, the great ceremony of the evening was to begin the harvest song, in which every man must join. He might be in tune, if he liked to be singular, but he must not sit with closed lips. The movement was obliged to be in triple time, the rest was ad libitum. As to the origin of this song, whether it came in its actual state from the brain of a single rhapsodist, or was gradually perfected by a school or succession of rhapsodists, I am ignorant. There is a stamp of unity, of individual genius upon it, which inclines me to the former hypothesis, though I am not blind to the consideration that this unity may rather have arisen from that consensus of many minds which was a condition of primitive thought, foreign to our modern consciousness. Some will perhaps think that they detect in the first quatrain an indication of a lost line, which later rhapsodists, failing in imaginative vigor, have supplied by the feeble device of iteration. Others, however, may rather maintain that this very iteration is an original felicity, to which none but the most prosaic minds can be insensible. The ceremony connected with the song was a drinking ceremony. That is perhaps a painful fact, but then, you know, we cannot reform our forefathers. During the first and second quatrain, sung decidedly forte, no can was filled. Here's a health unto our master, the founder of the feast. Here's a health unto our master, unto our mistress. And may his doings prosper, whether he takes in hand, for we are all his servants, and are at his command. But now, immediately before the third quatrain or chorus, sung fortissimo, with emphatic raps of the table, which gave the effect of cymbals and drum together, Alick's can was filled, and he was bound to empty it before the chorus ceased. Then drink, boys, drink, and see ye do not spill, for if ye do, ye shall drink too, for 'tis our master's will. When Alick had gone successfully through this test of steady-handed manliness, it was the turn of old Kester, at his right hand and so on, till every man had drunk his initiatory pint under the stimulus of the chorus. Tom Saft the rogue took care to spill a little by accident, but Mrs. Poyser, too officiously, Tom thought, interfered to prevent the exaction of the penalty. To any listener outside the door it would have been the reverse of obvious why the drink, boys, drink, should have such an immediate and often repeated encore, but once entered, he would have seen that all faces were at present sober, and most of them serious. It was the regular and respectable thing for those excellent farm laborers to do, as much as for elegant ladies and gentlemen to smirk and bow over their wine glasses. Bartle Massey, whose ears were rather sensitive, had gone out to see what sort of evening it was at an early stage in the ceremony, and had not finished his contemplation until a silence of 5 minutes declared that drink, boys, drink, was not likely to begin again for the next 12 months. Much to the regret of the boys and Toddy. On them the stillness fell rather flat, after that glorious thumping of the table, towards which Toddy, seated on her father's knee, contributed with her small might and small fist. When Bartle re-entered, however, there appeared to be a general desire for solo music after the choral. Nancy declared that Tim the Wagoner knew a song, and was lay singing like a lark i' the stable, whereupon Mr. Poyser said encouragingly, "Come, Tim, lad, let's hear it." Tim looked sheepish, tucked down his head, and said he couldn't sing, but this encouraging invitation of the master's was echoed all round the table. It was a conversational opportunity. Everybody could say, "Come, Tim," except Alick, who never relaxed into the frivolity of unnecessary speech. At last, Tim's next neighbor, Ben Tholoway, began to give emphasis to his speech by nudges, at which Tim, growing rather savage, said, "Let me Elwin, will ye? Else I'll my ye sing a tune ye wanna like." A good-tempered wagoner's patience has limits, and Tim was not to be urged further. "Well then, David, ye're the lad to sing," said Ben, willing to show that he was not discomfited by this check. "In my loves a ruse without a thorn." Apostrophe, the amatory David was a young man of an unconscious abstracted expression, which was due probably to a squint of superior intensity, rather than to any mental characteristic. For he was not indifferent to Ben's invitation, but blushed and laughed, and rubbed his sleeve over his mouth in a way that was regarded as a symptom of yielding. And for some time the company appeared to be much in earnest about the desire to hear David's song. But in vain. The lyricism of the evening was in the cellar at present, and was not to be drawn from that retreat just yet. Meanwhile the conversation at the head of the table had taken a political turn. Mr. Craig was not above talking politics occasionally, though he piqued himself rather on a wise insight than on specific information. He saw so far beyond the mere facts of a case, that really it was superfluous to know them. "I'm no reader o' the paper myself," he observed tonight, as he filled his pipe, "though I might read it fast enough if I liked, for there's Miss Liddy has 'em, and that's done with 'em I no time. But there's Mills, now, sits I the chimney corner, and reads the paper pretty nigh from morning to night, and when he's got to th and on he's more addle-headed than he was at the beginning. He's full o' this piece now, as they talk on. He's been reading and reading, and thinks he's got to the bottom on't. Why, lor bless you, Mills, apostrophe says I, you see no more into this thing, nor you can see into the middle of a potato. I'll tell you what it." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.